Music of John Johnson, Elizabethan era composer, played by the lutenist Oleg Timofeyev, who is in studio with me right now, as a matter of fact, along with Jeffrey Cohen. Jeffrey Cohen, who you may have heard me talk with him on the telephone earlier on about his organization. That is the Salish Sea Early Music Festival. And Jeffrey and Oleg are here in Spokane to play a program tonight at 7 o'clock at one of the newest emerging venues, one of the oldest structures in West Central neighborhood, but one of the emerging performance spaces. And that's the West Central Abbey on West Dean Avenue. And the program that they'll play there is called Folk Song from Three Centuries. And by the way, it's going to be repeated, that program, up the road in Colville. And that will be this Saturday. We'll talk about times and venue on that in a bit. But, gentlemen, welcome to From the Studio. Welcome to SPR Classical.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello.
And, Jeffrey, I'm going to start with you. For those who are coming to this fresh and have not heard about the festival before, tell us a little bit about the nature and the origins of the Salish Sea Early Music Festival. Obviously, there's a Seattle connection there. So,
yep. We started up as Concert Spirituel in the 80s, the 1980s, in Seattle, in a venue that was used quite a bit for period instrument music. And it involved Stanley Ritchie and Elizabeth Wright, who were Baroque violin and harpsichord. He taught at the University of Washington. Stephen Stubbs, lutenist, who's now the director of the Boston Early Music Festival. Sam Dalton is a wonderful Baroque oboe maker on Lopez. We see him. He often comes to the concerts and sometimes participates. So all the wonderful people, of which there weren't very many in Seattle at the time. And then my wife studied in Chicago, and we had this Concert Spirituel in Chicago, and that could be useful because Oleg just moved from Iowa City to Chicago, and maybe we'll start it up again. In any case, it came back when we moved back to Seattle there. And then we did something for which Oleg came out called the Cascade Early Music Festival. That was in Leavenworth. And that was for 2 years. And then my wife got a job up in Mount Vernon as a chaplain at the hospital, Gretchen. And she's a chaplain up in, for Providence Hospital up in Colville at this moment. And I had friends in various places up and down around Seattle and on the Puget Sound, which is also the Salish Sea, which is the Puget Sound combined with the Georgia Straits around Vancouver. That's the Salish Sea. So we expanded and ended up with 11 venues over there from Vancouver, BC, where we were on Tuesday, down to Tacoma. And so people come to town from Germany and Switzerland and who else is coming this year? Ukraine. A wonderful connection through Oleg, Elena Zhukova from Kiev came, was here for 23 concerts just a week ago. And so we have some very exciting people come. We rehearse like mad, and then we perform. And several days we do doubles. So we can do that because they're very different audiences separated by a ferry. And these local people are never going to get on a ferry and go somewhere else for a concert. So we can play on Lopez Island and then take a ferry and play in Friday Harbor on San Juan Island. We do that several times. So it morphed from Concert Spirituel, based just in Seattle. And by the way, that was the name of a very well-known series, as you may know, in Paris from 1725 through 1780s or something like that. So that's how that name originated. But now the Gretchen actually came up with the Salish Sea Early Music Festival, and it's quite appropriate because we're mostly around the Salish Sea, but it's just delightful to come here and play in Colville and Spokane, and those are the only two places we play this side of the mountains, and we come whenever we can. People love it. The main reason is the fabulous audiences in Spokane and Colville both. And by the way, we also, there's only one little grant that we get. We're entirely donation supported. Everyone can come for free to the concerts, and that includes tonight. There's a suggested donation. It's a free will offering of $20 to $30, but it works. Mm-hmm. And then we have some additional donations too, and this brings all these people from Ukraine and a wonderful Spanish harpsichordist from Switzerland and my old friend from Lübeck in northern Germany, Hans-Jürgen Schnorr, is coming in May. Elizabeth Wright is coming for the next concert from Indiana. She's one of the most well-respected harpsichordist teachers in the country. So the fact that it works is a little miracle. But we only have one grant outside of the donations, and that is in Colville. Robert Vinson left some money for the arts in Colville. So the Vinson Fund, administered by the city of Colville, helps us out a little bit. And this helps pay for us to bring people from the other side of the mountains. Of course, it takes us two extra days usually coming mm-hmm. and going, and people sure. love it. You go over 20 or you go over two or you come over 90. So it works very well, and we're delighted to expand the territory of the Salish Sea to Spokane.
Let me shift to tone here and get into the musical aspect of things and ask you both, at what point in your development or your training did the whole notion of becoming, shall I say, specialists in early music, when did that happen? Was there an event that triggered that, or was it just an evolution? Whoever wants to start.
Well, I started playing early music back in Russia, in Moscow. That was kind of the margins of early music movement. Everything was somewhat secondary, imitating some better known Western ensemble or something. I experienced what I call classical guitarist crisis, when you just keep looking around and you find out that all you play is transcriptions of lute music, and you really want to find the real lute. And that search took some time, but eventually I was able to locate a builder who made the lute, and I was discovering things pretty much firsthand, directly from the 17th century sources, because we were living behind the Iron Curtain, so we didn't really know anything. But it was getting more and more interesting. The more you find, the more it was kind of pulling me in. And I have to say, since then, my definition of early music has shifted. You know, when I started, I was charmed by the Renaissance, by Baroque. By now, early music is not about the time when, you know, repertoire was created, but rather by the approach that the artist chooses, the approach with a lot of attention to the sources, a lot of attention to the performance practice of the time when it was written. For example, I, on a historical guitar from the 19th century, I recorded 20th century music of a composer who spent 10 years in Stalin's gulag. But I also had manuscripts, and I also had my apparatus of approaching it as something remarkable for its time. So that's what early music is to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that your instrument to begin with was a guitar, yes?
Yeah.
Just the six-string guitar that we
yes,
all know.
Yes, Spanish guitar.
Mm-hmm. That's. And now you mentioned that the lute came in. Were you specific? Are you self-taught essentially on the lute, or?
I was self-taught when I came to this country, but since then, and it was in 1989, I had chance to study with, you know, with the creme de la creme of you know, lute pedagogy. Mm-hmm. But my initial introduction was from a facsimile of a book by Thomas Robinson called The School of Music, you know, music with this old ornate spelling. published in London in 1603. Mm. So directly from there, I learned how to read lute tablatures and so on.
The method book from the 17th century. Very good. Now, Jeffrey, your instrument is flute, but that doesn't begin to describe it. Again, tell us a little bit about your connection, your first connections with early music. You were raised and taught as a player of the modern flute to begin with.
And I love it. I love modern flute, and in fact, Elena from Ukraine, who plays harpsichord, she also plays piano. She just did there's a program online of her playing harpsichord music of the present by Ukrainian composers in Paris at a Columbia University hall in Paris. But she plays piano, and so I'm excited to explore with her modern Ukrainian music and also some music from Washington State by Robert Keckley and Huntley Byer and other composers that I know. So that will be a fun exploration. But in college, I did grow up on the modern flute, and I still play it, and I love it. But it's a very different ball of wax. It's completely different. I mean, you can and there are some modern flutists who play in recordings old music that's very well informed, as Oleg was saying. But there are certain things you simply cannot do. I mean, every one of these instruments evolved to be the perfect vehicle for the sound and the emotions and the musical texture that they wanted for that time. So it's a bit more of a jump between between the flutes, the modern flute and the modern contraption and the old flutes that are so much simpler. So after I graduated from the University of Washington, where I went to study oceanography, but I stayed because I had nice juicy, I was going to transfer to Oberlin. That was the one place I was interested in as a music school. But stayed because there was a lot of interesting things going on. I had a grant to be in the contemporary group, and I did a lot of early music because I joined with George Shangro, the Cohan Shangro duo, the announcer who was a good friend of Vern Windham, who helped us pick out the West Central. He's responsible for us playing at the West Central Abbey, which is a wonderful little place. So anyway, George was a wonderful conductor and also harpsichord player. And we had a duo. We played all over Europe, and Oleg and I have played all over Ukraine. But George and I played Baroque music you couldn't stop us. And that's pretty much what we did. And then I'd played all of this Baroque music and been so excited about it. We did all of the Bach sonatas in one program and that sort of thing. But then after that year, I was invited to be part of the Society for Asian Art Summer Festival in Seattle. And that's where I studied the Japanese shakuhachi, which only has four holes in the front and one thumb hole, and the South Indian flute. And they had wonderful people. Vishwanathan was the South Indian teacher, and Araki, I forget his first name, a master of shakuhachi. I just heard him in the Seattle Asian Art Museum. There was a recording of him with some statues of the Buddha and so on. So I just experienced him just 2 weeks ago with Elena. We went to the Seattle Art Museum. Anyway, so I studied those two simple flutes that are as simple as these. And then I went to Paris to study on a grant. And I met a harpsichordist, John Whitelaw, who introduced me to a harpsichord builder who had a Baroque flute, and he lent it to me. And because I had this experience with these Asian, the Japanese and South Indian flutes, I could play it right away, you know, this simple flute. And so I had quite an attraction to these very simple flutes. And then I ordered one, and then I went crazy with it after that, but I always did both. So I started with the Baroque flute, and then I went back in time to the Renaissance instrument, and then I went forward in time to the flute of Beethoven's time, which is very different. I have one sitting on the counter here, very different from the modern flute, which was invented in 1847.
I think everybody has a concept of the modern flute and the way it looks.
Yeah.
The mouthpiece and the valves.
Yeah.
First of all, a point of clarification. A lot of people, when they think about flute and early music, mind automatically goes to recorder.
Right.
This is not the flute that is in front of you and is
right.
Is sometimes called the beak flute, growing out of you.
Rather,
these are flutes that are played sideways,
right.
Traverse flutes.
And so they had that distinction in the time as well, and that confusion. So when they said flute, very often they meant recorder, but they said in England the German flute to mean the transverse flute. Or earlier in Europe, they said the Swiss flute, because the Swiss used a transverse flute in the military. And also they did say flauto traverso. They did brand it with the word transverse.
Okay. So let's talk specifically instruments here as we focus in on the program that you're going to be giving this evening at the West Central Abbey on West Dean Avenue here in Spokane. It's called Renaissance Psalms, Irish Baroque and Folk. And let's talk instruments for just a second. Of your large collection of instruments, both of you, which instruments are you playing? And just a brief note about if there's anything that distinguishes these. So, Jeffrey,
yes.
It says that you're going to be playing Renaissance descant tenor and bass, Baroque and 1828 keyed flutes.
Right.
So
I'll just very quickly go through those. So I'm not playing the descant flute. I did in our program last time, but I'm showing you, Jim, the three flutes. It looks like a mini little organ with a long one and then
medium-sized one
and smaller one.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the bass. The tenor, they called the normal one, which was the same range as the modern flute, but they considered it to be a tenor voice. And they considered it to be, they notated it an octave lower than it really sounded. And they said that. They knew that. But that's true. Isn't guitar notated an octave higher than it actually sounds? So I'm playing the tenor and the bass, Renaissance flutes. And then I skip to the Baroque flute. Those Renaissance flutes are just straight on the inside, a little bit tapered on the outside for various reasons. But on the inside, it's a cylinder, and all of the flutes after that have a taper in the bore. And with the Baroque flute, they put it in the body of the instrument. With the modern flute, the top piece tapers. It is not cylindrical in every modern flute. And whether you put the taper in the top or the bottom, it corrects the octaves. So this Baroque flute that seems so simple, that just has one key and the six holes and nothing for the thumb, is very far distant from the Renaissance flutes because of the taper in the bore. And that's why nobody plays Renaissance flute. So the Baroque flute that seems so simple is closer in terms of the fingerings to the modern flute, because the modern flute has the taper in the bore as well. So I go from the two Renaissance flutes, the tenor and the bass, to the Baroque flute, which is in four parts. Earlier they were in three, with one key and just the six holes, to the flute that's similar to that. They just started punching a bunch of holes in it, and they attach keys to hold the holes closed, and later on they learned how to use the keys more to their advantage. These are the flutes. This one is from 1820, similar to Oleg's guitar made in around 1820.
So that instrument, is that a copy of an 1820?
No, this is an original.
This is an original
from 1820.
That's pretty much a rarity, because those wooden instruments do, if they're not cared for properly, do tend to ultimately decay.
Yes, we have our preferences as to makers. The makers have only 40 or so flutes to choose from from the Renaissance flutes. All the rest of them have been, you know, thrown in the fire or whatever. They look so simple. They're just a tube of wood. So there are only about 40 left. And once I did something for the Boston Early Music Festival comparing three flutes by three different makers of the same original that's in the collection at the Fine Arts Museum in Boston. And they were all very, very different. Mm. So finding a maker that can do it is a real trick. And frankly, nobody can do it, you know, exactly. But you try to get as close as you can.
All right. And it's really fascinating to learn that the Baroque flute really is a genuine advancement in technology in terms of the design of it that we don't tend to think about always, reflecting back on that time period.
Although it's a sacrifice. You sacrifice with each advancement. There are things that you sacrifice to gain something. For instance, in the modern flute, you get volume and you get a strident tone color. At the same time, the modern flute existed with what they called then the old system flute. And Verdi liked the modern flute because it was more like a soprano voice that stood apart. It's like, well, you're familiar with the development of the organ. When organ stops became more like soloists and more bright and strident, whereas the Baroque organs, all the different stops blend.
It's ensemble.
So you've lost that blend.
Okay. Oleg, you are going to be playing on this program three different instruments. You'll be starting with the lute and then going to the instrument that you're going to play for us shortly here, the English guitar. Describe the English guitar, because I think people might be really fascinated with the fact that, among other things, you tune it with a key.
Yeah. English guitar appeared in England in the middle later half of the 18th century. It's connected to the citron family, so it's not really a guitar. It's pear-shaped. It has double and single strings, usually six courses, and they're usually tuned to a C major chord, sometimes to another chord. Those are wire strings. They sound very pretty. Well, the thing is that the musical canon was created by musicologists who were interested in masterpieces. And although the repertoire for the English guitar is vast, there aren't many great names. It was composed mainly for women to play simple music at the fireplace. So most of those pieces are relatively simple and in C major, to the key of the tuning. Only very recently we got sort of musicians here and there in Great Britain, in the States, who are actually interested in, you know, approaching this repertoire. And I'm one of them for the somewhat unusual reason, because of Britain's unique role in world economics and politics in the 18th century. The instrument became popular everywhere, including United States, including many European countries, and including Eastern Europe and Russia. And the instrument came to Russia in the 1790s, but it didn't become a Russian thing to do, but instead it kind of led to a creation of a hybrid of the English guitar and the Spanish guitar. And that hybrid, I called it the Russian seven-string guitar, and I spent last 35 years or so basically discovering this repertoire, writing about it, recording CDs and so on. After the war began, it became kind of uncomfortable for me to call it the Russian seven-string guitar, and I simply address it as the seventh string guitar, which I will be playing tonight as well.
All right, very good. And the repertoire, again, the title of the program, Renaissance Psalms, Irish Baroque and Folk. The program given at 7 o'clock at the West Central Abbey here in Spokane and repeated on Saturday evening? The time
at 4 in the afternoon.
At 4 in the afternoon at the Crossroads Event Center in Colville, up the road from us. Briefly, as we need to get your playing fairly quickly here, describe the program tonight, or maybe a couple of key pieces that are part of it.
Well, I'll start with the first part of the program, which is based on psalm tunes, and actually that's not folk music, but it's popular music. So I guess the kernel word would better be popular music than folk, because everyone had these melodies that they heard in church on the tip of their tongue. So everyone played variations on the psalm tunes, and Vallée in 1620 wrote variations on all of them, and Van Eyck used 15 of them, and he was also a carillonneur. His job was to play the bell towers of Utrecht, so he went from church to church playing, and sometimes welcome dignitaries that would enter the city from that direction, playing popular melodies, but also these hymn tunes that were based on tunes from the Genevan Psalter, the psalm tunes from the mid-1500s. And so we are exploring as much as we can this area and putting together these variations by Van Eyck and by Vallée, a virtuoso flute player, because Van Eyck would come down from the bell tower and play his little flute in the garden. And there were many poems about him. He was a celebrated flute player of the time. So he would improvise his variations. He was blind, but he played them for someone who wrote them all out. So we have this documented, and Vallée wrote his out as well. And we put them together and we show the great degree to which they agreed in terms of how they would elaborate upon these tunes. It's very interesting for us. And then we're doing a folk tune by another lute player, Valerius. So we're getting those guys together. We're, as if in a time machine, we're getting Van Eyck and these two other lute players together in the same room to play together.
Then the second part, or the second aspect of the program here, two words that you don't see together too often, Irish Baroque. When we think about music of that period, we tend to think of continental Europe. We tend to think, of England and Great Britain.
Well, I think most of our music is actually Scottish Baroque. It's known that the Romantics were fascinated with the music of the North, romanticized Scotland, etc. But that fashion started earlier. Already in the 18th century, there was a certain interest in unusually sounding Scottish tunes. Actually, even earlier, on my first lute CD, which I recorded in 1999, there are lute solos, the Scottish tunes from as early as 1620s. So by the middle of the 18th century, Scottish tunes here and there, collections of the best Scots tunes, became kind of a norm. So one of those collections that we use is by Italian composer Barsanti, who set them with a traditional, for the time, basso continuo accompaniment. The other is by James Oswald, actually a Scottish composer. And Oswald is kind of a key figure because he was publishing music, collections of Scots tunes, but he also published music for the English guitar. And so we decided to adapt some of his pieces from a collection that probably Jeffrey should talk about.
Okay, and our time, though, is running short here. So I think I'm going to, at this point, take the chance to thank you both for coming in today and telling us about these programs that are going to be happening. And there are other programs down the road for the Salish Sea Early Music Festival here in Spokane. One in May, of featuring the music of George Frideric Handel and J.S. Bach. And then as well in June, on June 14th, that features solely the music of Bach. Both of these programs in Spokane at St. Augustine Church on the South Hill. And I hope that you guys go, well, I hope that Jeffrey and maybe another of your musicians can come by right before then. But this program from tonight, the selections that you're going to play are from that, yes?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about what we'll hear, and then I'll send you out to the studio.
Well, we a component of that second part of the program, and you'll just have to come tonight to find out about the third, is with the English guitar, and we're really excited about that. Anne Ford was a wonderful English guitar player, and she played the glass harmonica, which Mozart wrote for, and she wrote a book about the glass harmonica and wrote this book with some music that we'll be playing. And apparently is it Women's History Month?
It's Women's History, yeah. March is Women's History Month, so it's appropriate that we hear from a female composer.
And then Oleg mentioned that we're looking at The Seasons by James Oswald, which were his little mini sonatas that are not directly from the music of his heritage, the Scottish music, but they speak very strongly of his music. We think they're just perfect, these The Seasons, of which there are 100 little pieces, 25 for each season, from which we're playing 3 for spring. And we thought of playing Jonquil, the flower, which is in 2 little mini parts, an air and then a little gigue. And then we thought of playing something by Anne Ford that she wrote, a little minuet.
All right. Gentlemen, again, thank you so much. It's been a delight, and I really look forward to your playing here. So I will send you out to the studio, and then we will get to hear these pieces. Okay. Thank you.
The Jonquil. And now a minuet by Anne Ford.